we used to practice seated meditation and walking meditation in the days of the Pebble Hill Sangha, and in the early transition days from that into the Night Sky Sangha. But for these number of years since 2010, togetherness is a conversation, which doesn't exclude meditation, but instead of that meditation being, you could say, silent and seated and internal, this is open-eyed and conversational and internal. Yeah. The emphasis of our conversations is unchanging, but always has a different twist on it, which is the discovery of the present, let's call it texture of consciousness, as contrasted with our familiar mind's attention, which is on content, right? The storyline, the narrative that we bring to current experience going on in our, you know, head or spoken out loud, seems to become the working or operative reality field, right? That which is being thought of and thought about and spoken pretends to be representative of the reality field, whereas in this kind of emphasis, the reality field is textural. It's one's attention, instead of going to narration or story, whether of past, present, or future, one's attention learns how to discover what, let's call it presence for lack of a better word, feels like. So it's more of a feeling tone kind of meditation than it is other forms. The one of the taglines on the website is palpable immersion in the nature of direct experience, leading invariably to realization. So that's kind of how this works. All right, your turn.
I think pretty much for my life, I had this, at the time when I was so little, I didn't know it was spiritual, but I know I had this closeness to Buddhism. And my grandmother, who functioned as a nanny, she was very like a pious kind. Mm-hmm. She, only her belief system, because she really set us, when we were able through the school years, we saw her way more than our parents.
Mm-hmm.
Our parents were, into careers and very emotionally remote. And then they didn't believe anything, definitely. Now Buddha is not anything that you cannot see and touch.
Mm-hmm.
But my grandmother, on the other hand, she had a very strong sense of there's more than, this human form of what I can see.
Yeah.
And, she wasn't like lecturing to me that much. Actually, she was she never went to school,
mm-hmm.
From old China. And, but she had this very sure believing that you know, for example, your behavior. If your behavior is a, you know, definitely is a cause, and then what later on we experience is caused by your own behaviors.
Yes.
So she was very clear about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she also embedded that in me. And then when the bigger environment was totally different. So I had that influence growing up. And later on, when I, you know, became, you know, when, I think when I was in college, I had this even more, like, the, you know, this like an inner, very strong desire to find out more while the other, you know, peers, you know, in, you know, around 20s, they were into, you know, that age stuff, artists, you know,
sure,
dating stuff.
Yes.
But I just saw it as a waste of time and energy with it. And so I kind of searched into more of this kind of books. You know, at the time there was more library, you know, accessories to me than, you know, my previous years. So I used that. And then I found out there's a lot more, you know, in Buddhism, there's so many schools.
Many, many, yes.
Yeah. And
yes,
almost every school made their own thing. And I felt that was more like a what do you call it? Like a scholar research kind of direction, rather than you know what Buddha taught, the basic, you know. And so I want to stay with, you know, as close as to Buddha's teaching rather than different schools.
Yeah.
So I didn't really. Because it's all about being, if I don't join any of the schools, you know,
right.
I wasn't really, like, belong to anywhere. So after I came here, I went to, I think it's called the Philadelphia Buddhist Association.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they meditation, walking meditation. I went that a few times. And then later on in Telford, there was a new Buddhist temple.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went there, they don't, you know, they I don't know why they didn't use English, mostly Vietnam.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. And I felt, you know, I could meditate there because the setting was very, I don't know, the energy was good.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I felt I could not really participate because they were all, you know, speaking Vietnam and I don't speak that at all.
Yes.
So, I just like went online.
Right.
So I think my goal, I felt in this incarnation, is was really the main, because that shows up in front of me again and again.
Mm.
It's a, you know, focus on, I don't know, it's enlightenment, it's the right word, it's really awakening from, like, from this just human mind level.
Yes. Yes.
And really experience, you know, what Buddha was teaching.
Yes.
So, you know, unfortunately, all the accessible places, including Ida, almost none really doing, I mean, talking about the meditation.
Right.
Really doing the, you know, I call it Buddhist meditation. It's really the way Buddha meditated.
Mm.
You know, he sat under the Buddha tree and then just determined, you know, I won't get up until, you know.
Right.
Yeah. So I want that kind of my true,
yes.
Yeah, I don't know if you call it working towards that instead of, you know, other ways, you know, use NGOs, use, you know, other medias, you know, to combat you. So I feel, you know, everyone has the ability to access their own spiritual energy,
mm-hmm.
and then really experience that themselves rather than through a medium. So a medium.
Yes.
So anyway, I mean, through this kind of practice, I, you know, came across a lot, you know, related with egoic minds, human psychology.
Oh, sure.
And, mm-hmm. you know, all kinds of way of meditation, you know, from schools from India, and then there are ways, you know, they do it in China. They all, you know, develop certain ways, but that doesn't mean, you know, that would definitely work.
No.
For the next guy, you know.
That's right.
So, you know, and then it's also trying everything too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, you know, told myself to have an open mind, and, you know, the main thing is really the result.
Of course.
Yeah, and that will, you know, will be the, you know, so-called the right way, or the way now, right working, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care whatever, you know, other people meditate or try to connect with their higher self or whatever works for them, that's fine. But I just want that kind of experience firsthand myself.
Yes.
Even it works, you know, you know, there are many, many ways, you know, in China that is called the Zen Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, you know, yeah, they meditate a lot, they do their ritual, but they practice and the meditation when they are working in basically the form of you should be meditate 24 hours, even in your sleep. Of
right.
course, I can't do that.
Sure.
But the awake hours, you know, if I can observe my mind, knowing is my mind able to focus or concentrate on what I'm doing, or my mind is somewhere else worrying about a certain
right.
Thing.
You yes.
know, that is my practice.
Sure.
So, you know, I don't make it recommendation, you know, you need to meditate this way. No, I think everybody has their own way to reach the awakening.
Absolutely, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The, you know, what we call mind, you could say is attention turned into narrative. So before thinking, choosing, deciding, considering, discerning occurs, attention is always prior or foundational.
Right.
So one's nature then could be said to be of the nature of non-specific attention, which is not focused on any particular impulse that arises in the five sense windows or in mind itself. The kinds of mindfulness practices that encourage or reinforce one being attentive to, right? Easily, you could say, degrades or degenerates into what is the nature of attention without narration, without noting or saying dreamy, sleepy, focused, present, right? In other words, if there's no story or narration that accompanies attention, then attention has, it's open. So certain forms of mindfulness in an attempt, and sometimes it's successful, sometimes not, to arouse interest in attention itself, will use mindfulness, right, as a kind of a companion program. But oftentimes mindfulness is, what am I mindful of, right? So if I'm mindful of what I think is the content of my experience, well, then that's fine. I'm mindful of the story or the narration or how I'm feeling or how one thought triggers another, triggers another, triggers another. And that's great training, but it also, in a sense, encourages a certain kind of distractibility. So it's challenging to, let's say, chart a course for, you could say, a quality of meditation or contemplative interest that is attention is interested in attention. Or if you want to call it awareness, is interested in awareness. Or mindfulness is interested in, you could say, just availability. Without landing on an object. And in that way, then maybe ideally one becomes accustomed to the fact of present attention. Period. Without it having to be utilitarian. What we can refer to as, you know, egoic mind is the habit to impose utilitarian value on attention. And so then the narrative mind gets, you know, lit, and it operates therefore in a kind of abstraction. You could even refer to it as a low grade hysteria. Because instead of being, you could say, available without specificity, available without content, right? The mindfulness grabs objects, 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 and then tells fanciful stories, right? About one's so-called past, one's so-called present, if there were one, or, you know, the anticipation, joyfully or otherwise, of one's future. And all of that is just, right, abstract neuronal firing that occurs in our mind as, right, language. It's not spoken, it's thought, right? But thinking, in order to trace thinking, in a sense, one could say one is speaking to oneself. Right? Yeah, we're speaking, not out loud, but to ourselves. Now, a funny thing about thinking, one of many, is that we appear to be both the author of thinking, I'm thinking, and therefore it appears that maybe I'm choosing what it is I will think next, which is not true, but we appear to be the author of thinking and concomitantly or simultaneously with that, the recipient or the listener to the thinking. So it's like in our own mind, not even saying a word out loud, There's a kind of a, we'll call it a duality of persona, as if I'm thinking, which suggests I'm the author, right, of what's being thought, and the recipient or the listener to what is being thought. Which am I? Both? Neither? And how is it curiously possible, if it is, that the magical capacity for thinking, which occurs, right, quite spontaneously, and you could say free of any willfulness. Thinking arises like all phenomena arises, right? Mellifluously, beautifully, in an unconditioned manner. But we make the claim that I'm thinking. And then we could say this, you know, miracle of sentience, of aliveness, of awakeness, appears to be an individuated experience or an individuated journey, which is reinforced through the power of narration, the power to tell a story to myself as the author and the listener of my so-called own mind, imagining that what's being thought about is real. And that mechanism, if it's a mechanism, maybe it's more of, you know, fairy dust, it might be a magic wand, it might not be a mechanism, lends itself to the ongoing sense of being individually existent and, right, privately occurring in the privacy of your own mind, of your own thinking, which is clearly not somebody else's thinking. This habit to identify with thinking as the functional reality field for myself is what we could call delusion or distraction, misrepresentation. The Buddha's encounter with Mara under the Bodhi tree had, when he made his commitment to be there, you could say poetically, if not practically, was Mara, as the assailant, right, of distraction, was pounding the Buddha with all kinds of seductions, you know, whether lust or fear or greed or grandiosity or, right? And Mara is depicted as mind, as the capacity to abstract. And the Buddha's resolve through the touching the earth, right? His final defeat of Mara by touching the earth was to say, I am a child of, right, this mother, this Gaia, this earth. And that gives me the right to dispel you. And it was that final gesture after they were, you know, kind of duking it out that Mara was defeated and relented. So the Buddha was, well, successful in his one night stand. And that's a metaphor. I'm not saying it did or didn't happen. I didn't have the privilege of being under the tree with him during his trials, but we could look at that encounter as a lovely metaphor for our own, you know, spiritual journey. What is the nature of our or Buddha's wakefulness? What's its nature? Is it dependent upon sentience, consciousness, narrative, I thought? Or perhaps it's a pervasive, we'll say non-dual. Maybe we could use the word understanding, but even understanding suggests, right, an agent, understanding a concept. Whereas the understanding we're suggesting is exactly this, exactly now, exactly here, released from the, right, sense of an individuated person marching through time. And that's the revelation. In a sense, you could say, this is this. And, you know, not to be demeaning, what of it? But the, you know, the human that imagines him or herself to be under the influence of dissatisfaction, spiritual or existential dissatisfaction answers that question. This is this, impersonally, spontaneously, serendipitously, mellifluously, marvelously, tragically occurring the way that it is, the way that it's felt. But then the mind comes in and says, answers the question, well, what of it? Well, the answer to that is, well, what about me? Right? The reflex of the sense of personal continuity, personal existential viability is always, what about me? What about me? What about me? What about me? Ongoing. All identification, in a sense, is, well, what about me? What do I think? What do I feel? What's happened to me? What's happening to me now? What will happen to me hence? You see, so a kind of a magical, non-existent, persona or agent is created out of nothing, just out of the movement of ideation, the movement of narration, a sense of I as being separate from what this already is. You could say gets its working papers, is created out of thin air. And then we associate with this I for the long run. And if we're looking at it carefully, that sense of I, it could be a misnomer. Maybe this is not I, but whatever this is exactly what it is. And we don't have to name it, know it, compare it, value, judge it, or do anything about it at all. And that kind of, you could say, release, could be realization or steps on the path of realization. So this is it. This is one's realization. It's never not one's realization. What else could it be? But we have the habit, right? By naming, associating, memory, time, self, I, to be able to convince ourselves quite magically that this is something less than realization. That I find in this plenty of evidence for dissatisfaction or anxiety or all kinds of afflictive, right, emotional and psychological states which appear to be obscuring what this already is. We qualify present experience unceasingly. And the magical capacity to qualify present experience unceasingly is the engine or the evidence of what appears to be separative existence.
That's where the suffering comes from.
Yes, that is suffering. Yeah. Separative existence is always at risk. It's unsatisfiable, not just unsatisfied, it's unsatisfiable. Separative existence is separate, other than. And that sense of other than makes us prone to all forms of suffering, right? Psychological and emotional and all kinds of suffering. Yes, that's right. Because we associate our identity with the body, the separate body, or the separate mind, or our curious, if not lovable, behavioral proclivities or behavioral habits. You know, I know how I feel. I know how I think. I have my beliefs and belongings and superstitions and personal history and the things I'm working on my way to be a, you know, better person someday, which is suffering. If we are self-identified at the root, that is suffering. It lends itself to all kinds of irritability and unsatisfactoriness. we tend to focus on circumstances and events as the evidence of suffering, right? If only he would, if only she would, if only I had, if only I didn't have, if only I, if only this, if only that, if only, right? So we're dependent on circumstances and events being the problem, interfering with our spiritual well-being. But circumstances and events have nothing to do with anything. Yes, right. And perhaps subtler. I mean, we refer to the human mind because we think. And so we're like, the human mind thinks, right? But it's possible that prior to thought, thinking, narration, the seeds of identity, self-identity, are subtler than that. So it may not be narration itself, or even the I presumption, that is the cause. It might be something more magical or more subtle that is, let's say, hypnotizing, you know, subtly hypnotizing, so that before we even think or name or compare, there's already evidence of self, of individuation. And if that's the case, maybe, just playing around, if that's the case, then maybe our meditations might not reach that sufficiently subtle level. So if we misdiagnose, and if our interventions, our spiritual interventions, are incapable of really honing in on the root or the nuance of, right, individuation, we're not going to be able to unravel it. Because we're operating too superficially. We're operating too symptomatically. So before one is certain of I, what is this? What is present experience? Just before, prior to, right, the assertion or the confidence one places in I. It's quite magical, actually. Without a timestamp, without authorship, without implication, without strategy, what is this? And it doesn't need a name or an explanation or a Genesis story. It doesn't need a cosmology or a religious, you know, foundation of any kind. It's perfectly palpable. Presence is perfectly palpable without having a history. And I would suggest that that kind of discovery might ideally contribute to deepening sense of freedom. Deepening sense of freedom.
Freedom.
Because awareness, rather than being tethered to I, me, my, and the story of self, releases and simply discovers non-specificity. The discovery of non-specificity, which is always what this is, could, let's just say, mature into an unanticipated realization.
That's the theory of oneness.
Indeed.
Yeah, you don't. It's like this person or individual is not the center anymore.
That's right.
It is just this.
Yes. Yeah, here it is. Yeah. This is just this. So there's no longer grasping, acquiring, molding, right? There's no resistance. There's no bracing or anticipation. There's no cleverness. Yeah. And that, this is, let's just say for fun, the self-realization that everyone's talking about. Who would have thought that present experience is both the means, the on-ramp, and the fruition of realization? This is realization. There's no place to go or not go. There's nothing to do or not do. There's no need to, let's say, focus one's attention on being preferential at all. With the habit of self-reference, relaxing, 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 then one's sense of self evaporates quite organically.
Yeah, I think when, once you come to that feeling, the mind is almost useless. And you don't need the mind.
You do not.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You could say one's innermost inner loyalty, instead of going to the mind for companionship or explanation, learns how to rest in presence itself. One's most intimate vitality, this present moment, instead of reaching to the mind for companionship or narrative, rests in itself. There's no religion there. There's no mind there. There's no longer any strategy. Even, you could say, one's hopes of eventual self-realization is also gone. Rather than restlessness and acquisition, restlessness and strategy, we floating on a lily pad, floating on a lily pad, floating with no coordinates. And the drama field of humankind, which of course will persist in all the ways that it will persist, needn't be the defining nature of our so-called experience. Presence is not perturbed by the throbbing drama field of human nature, of civilization. Even the so-called certainty of being existent softens. The habit and over-reliance on self-referencing yields entirely to this present intelligence.